This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
I'm Bob Main, and you are listening to another episode of the Handgun World Show. Episode 106, to be exact. The reason I carry a gun is because cops don't fit in my holster. So thanks for tuning in. Have you ever wondered what it's like to procure and shoot collectible firearms? That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about vintage firearms today and collectible firearms. This is another interview show where I brought a gentleman named Rick Brenneman on the line with me, and we talked about collectibles. Now, Rick likes to collect guns. He also likes to shoot what he collects, which is really kind of what I think is kind of neat. Rick Brenneman is the Rick from the Power Factor show. Steve Zofie and Rick Brenneman, as you know, they do a show called Power Factor, which is now on the Gun Rights Radio Network. So more about that a little bit later. So before getting into the interview, I want to talk about some announcements real quick. A couple of things I want to get out up front here, and then I got another one for you towards the end of the show. The website, handgunworld.com. That's handgunworld.com. If you want to email me directly, bob@handgunworld.com. Don't forget to check me out on YouTube. You can search Handgun World Show. Don't forget to go to the Gun Rights Radio Network. Just like all the other podcasters on the GRRN, I've got my own thread there at the forum, so if you want to join that forum, if you're not a member, let me invite you to do so, and you can comment on these shows and send me suggestions and so forth. Also, don't forget to check me out on Shooters Legion and Facebook. You can search Handgun World Show on both of those networking sites. So let me cover a little bit of a listener feedback here before I get into it. You know, you guys send me a lot of good emails, and I really appreciate that. You know, I don't consider myself an expert in any shape or form when it comes to firearms. You know, I've only been doing this a little over 6 years, so it's just kind of a passion and a hobby of mine. But I like to inject my opinions and my feelings every once in a while. And a while back, I answered a guy's question who emailed me about carrying his gun on the opposite side of his strong hand. Well, a gentleman named Russell Glenn from North New Orleans Blade Works has sent me a response to that, and I thought it was pretty good. He said that he wanted to kind of inject his opinion on the concept of carrying a gun on your weak side. Okay, Russell didn't think it was a very good idea. One of the things that he says is, he says, short of a physical disability, he thinks it's a poor choice. Transitions between hands under stress are slow and clumsy at best, and the chance of dropping your weapon is phenomenal. And in a situation where seconds count, that is a death warrant. He also says he has no permanent solution for the guy's issue, but he advises against it. And anyway, he wanted to put his two cents in there. Now, I have to agree here. You know, I think it's important that If you're going to try something like that, that you really practice it. But, you know, I agree with Russell here that it is a poor choice. You know, if unless you really have a really bad impairment, physical impairment, I would agree with Russell on this, that it's just not a good idea to try. Tough situation, though, to the person who sent me that email a while back, a couple weeks ago. It's a tough call whether you should do that or not, or whether you should, you know, draw with your right hand and transition it to your left or vice versa. But, you know, it makes it tough. You know, carry your gun on your strong side and learn to deal with it as best as possible. That's my suggestion. Okay, next, Ken in Oregon sent me an email commenting about my last show, where I had my shooting buddy James on here, and he was talking about his Beretta PX4 Storm. And James was talking about making a modification to his gun and changing the safety to a decocker on the Beretta PX4 Storm. As some of you know, it's a double-action, single-action gun, and it's also got a manual safety on it that I didn't like when I tried it because you had to flip it up. Well, Ken said he'd like to do the same thing himself to his gun. And he wanted to know that if I could do a review on it, or if James and I could do a review on it, if James decided to make that modification. So, James, are you listening? I know you are. If you do decide to make that modification, let me know how it goes. Maybe you can come back on the show and let Ken in Oregon know how you like that. Ken also wants to know if there's any problems with the rotating barrel locking up on that. Well, that I don't know. I'm going to go ahead and let James answer that. Maybe he'll get on the forum. If any of you out there own a Beretta PX4, especially the subcompact, and you've got a comment on that, on whether you've had a problem with the rotating barrel locking up, let us know about that. I think that would be some good information. Okay, Zach sent me some feedback. He was listening to James and I talk about why I thought there that it was a shame that there wasn't anybody else that was packing heat at the scene where Gabrielle Giffords was shot and several others were shot and killed on that tragic day in Tucson. And this is interesting. Zach in Phoenix says he's an Arizonan, and he's not particularly surprised. He said Tucson and part of the city around the Oro Valley and the Catalina foothills has a bit of a higher granola and patchouli factor than other areas of the state, with the exception of Flagstaff. Boy, what a lousy time to get a phone call. All right, anyway, I thought that was interesting, a higher granola and patchouli factor. He said Phoenix and Maricopa County are much different. Now, Eric Shelton, let me tell you, if you're listening, you know, you being there in Tucson, you probably know. Tell me, is that true? I mean, it probably is. Zach probably knows what he's talking about, but I wonder what a patchouli factor is. I'd like to know that. Anyway, thanks for sending in the comment. Oh, and by the way, Zach also says that he was in a car with his folks and a girlfriend about a 15-minute drive away from that Safeway when the shooting occurred. He was packing a SIG 229 in 40 Smith & Wesson in a Comptac SeaTac holster. Interesting stuff. Okay. Thanks a lot again, Zach. Appreciate you sending in that comment. Now, this next comment was sent to me from one of the best rock and roll bands that I've ever listened to, by the name of Molly Hatchet. seriously, no, it wasn't the real Molly Hatchet that sent me this comment, but you know, when you get an email, you know, you see the person's name first that sent you the email. Well, a gentleman named Stace, he sends me emails and it says it's coming from Molly Hatchet, which I think is pretty cool. Anyway, Stace says he listened to episode 105 when I was talking about the Glock 32. He said his Glock 32 is his daily carry gun. And he said, yes, he does feel it. Matter of fact, he tore up his hand. He tore up the web of his hand between the thumb and the index finger. It got all bloody and rubbed raw when he took a 1,000-round class in 2 days with a Glock 357 SIG. So, hey, Molly Hatchet, you know what? Stick to rock and roll instead of going to classes with your Glock 32. No, just kidding. Anyway, Stace, thanks again for sending that in. You know, the recoil was pretty stout on that thing. I have to say, though, in my humble opinion, the recoil was more manageable on that Glock 32 357 SIG than it was on any 40 caliber Glock that I've shot at. Just, you know, that's just my personal opinion. I think it's better than the 40 caliber Glocks, period. And again, I'm not picking on 40 caliber Glocks. All of you who are 40 cal fans, please don't want to drop your hatchet on me just because I said that. No offense. It's just, for me, the 40 cals don't work. I just don't like them. Okay, so that wraps up the listener feedback. I wanted to get those out of the way, and I don't like to wait too long to respond to you guys. Thanks for these comments. This is good stuff. Keep them coming. Okay, before I introduce my guest, let me tell you that I struggled again with this interview with my recording software. I don't know what it is, but it may sound choppy at times, and I had a real bad echo. My voice was echoing. Rick's voice came through just fine. I was using Skype, and I was using a recording program software, and I don't know what it is, so I had to go through and do a lot of fancy editing, folks. I don't usually do a lot of editing, just a little bit of tweaking here and there. On this podcast, I had to do a lot of fancy editing. Mostly, you're going to hear Rick talking, but that's okay. You guys hear enough of me, and Rick has excellent information about collectible firearms. So Most of what you're going to hear is him talking about it. I did the very best I could to get rid of the echoes. Some of this interview I had to completely cut out to get rid of the echoing effect. Again, I don't know what caused it. I'm working on it, folks. I'm working on it. Interviews are a big part of this show, and there's a lot of people that have a lot of good things to say on that, on stuff. So I may have to just use another computer because it might be computer problems that I'm having, which is causing the echo. So my apologies for that. Anyway, let's take a quick break, a little bit of a commercial here from the Gun Rights Radio Network and gunfacts.info, and then I'll bring Rick on, and then I've got some comments when Rick is done to close out the show. Don't go away. Be right back.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is bloviating about gun shows, blaming these congenial get-togethers as a source of violence in his city. Bloomberg evidently hasn't listened to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which reports that less than 1% of guns used in crimes were bought at a gun show. Bloomberg might want to listen to the Anti-Gun Center to Prevent Handgun Violence, which surveyed large police departments and learned that less than 5% of cop shops felt that gun shows were a problem. Better yet, Bloomberg should put a chain on his local thugs and leave out-of-state gun shows alone. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, for the main topic of this episode, I have another interview for everybody. I am joined by Rick Brenneman from the great state of Washington. How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Good. Let me introduce Rick to everybody here, and I'm going to do the best I can. And Rick, I want you to chime in when I get done, because I'm sure I'll probably mess something up. But I got a chance to meet Rick, or to get to know him at least via email and a little bit here by phone, from Steve Zofi. And Rick, you're the Rick from the Power Factor show, right?
I am the Rick from the Power Factor show, yes.
All right. And so I'll start off by plugging their show. It's powerfactorshow.com. I've watched every one of their video podcasts so far. They're on the Gun Rights Radio Network. And Rick, you're a competitive IDPA shooter, right?
Yes, I shoot actually both IDPA and USPSA enthusiastically.
You're a master class shooter, aren't you?
I'm an A-class shooter in USPSA and an expert in IDPA.
An expert in IDPA. Okay, you're one level ahead of me. I'm still a sharpshooter.
Well, I was a sharpshooter for many, many years.
And I just want to let everybody know, we're not really going to talk about competition shooting today because Rick has another interest, and I'll let you in on that. And I wanted to bring him on because it's a really unique subject. But how long you been shooting, first of all? Tell us that.
Well, I started as a kid. My dad, of course, you know, as American dads, I think, traditionally used to do, taught their kids to shoot when they were young. So I've been shooting since I was about 10 years old, and I'm 50 now, so 40 years, including some. I took an NRA basic pistol class along the way, but my dad certainly got me started at a young age.
Yeah, don't you love it? You know, same thing with my dad. It's great. And I'm, you know, I got my son involved already, and he's only 12.
Yeah, great, great.
So, all right. Well, we're going to talk about collectible firearms, and we're not going to necessarily talk about the value of collectible guns and stuff, but Rick's more of an accumulator. And one of the things, Rick and I had a chance to chat before this interview, and one of the things he was telling me was that he likes to accumulate, but he likes to shoot what he accumulates. Is that right?
Yeah. A gun that I own that I can't shoot is kind of a bit of a frustration for me.
Okay. Well, it's a frustration for me too. And so I'm going to ask Rick to talk about, you know, some of the dangers in shooting collectible firearms. And we're going to talk a little bit about vintage firearms and things. And we're going to talk about basically some obsolete guns and stuff like that, or maybe you still shoot them and so forth. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into that?
Well, my dad kind of preceded me as the accumulator in the family, and back in the golden age of cheap surplus firearms in the 50s and 60s, he was able to buy, you know, a lot of World War One and World War Two surplus military weapons that were widely available, mail order, you know, for ridiculously cheap prices, or they seem ridiculous now, you know, $15, $20, $25. And a lot of the people of that generation, the kind of the tail end of the greatest generation, were hunters to a much greater extent than today. And so most of the male menfolk in my family, on both my mom's side and my dad's side, had at least a certain interest in firearms. And so growing up, I was exposed to that. I mean, going to the landfill to sight in before deer season and some of that stuff. And I sort of, amongst all the nephews, grandchildren, you know, depending on whose perspective that is, I kind of had the enduring interest in firearms. And so I've just been exposed to a lot of these older guns and, of course, kind of the older tales that go along with them.
Right. Well, that's kind of cool. I think that's great. So your dad preceded you, and he kind of groomed you into doing that, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, by the time I was 12 or 13 years old, he very slyly had taught me how to field strip and clean all the guns in the house. And so, of course, I thought it was awesome being, you know, given this great responsibility, but it allowed my dad to take the afternoon off after we'd been at the range.
Well, now that's kind of, you know, maybe I might borrow that idea.
Yeah, it works pretty well.
Well, one of the things I want to ask you right off the bat is, what do you mean when you say you're not really a collector? You say you're more of an accumulator, and you have some interest in doing that, and you like to shoot what you accumulate. You want to give some examples?
Well, yeah. I mean, I usually think of a collector as somebody that has a focus, say, on a particular type of firearm. Like, you'll hear about somebody who collects Lugers, or it'll be a collection of, you know, like World War II weaponry, or something. They've got a kind of a focus. And from my perspective, I guess I don't have that focus. I'll see some gun that I think is pretty cool, and I have a problem of kind of focusing on something and almost being obsessed by it until I get it. And so, although it's not necessarily has to do with vintage firearms, there's a certain firearm that's kind of been on the cusp of being introduced now for a couple of years, and I can just hardly stand it that it's not available. And so, I'll just focus in on something. And so, like, you know, for instance, I'll have a specific gun and it sits on the shelf and I'll see it and I'll go, boy, it'd be great if I could shoot that. And I'll find, you know, the ammunition is long since obsolete, or it is available, but it's very expensive. And so, you know, kind of I started this process of, okay, let's shoot this gun. You know, it'll be a gun, let's say, that I've had for years and I've never shot it. And I'll go, okay, what is it going to take to fire this gun? And I'll start either looking for factory ammo, or if it's not readily available, is there something, you know, I'm an avid hand loader, so is it possible that I could convert some other components to work in this gun? And then I have to look into, you know, load data and what bullet diameter. And so it kind of escalates into a process of discovery and then trying to actually put the thing together so it'll shoot.
Well, you know, and I'm glad you're bringing that up, because that leads me to my next question. What do you think are some of the dangers in shooting collectible firearms?
Well, because they are collectible, a lot of it depends on the value of the gun. And depending on what kind of a collector you are, you know, you could have a gun in your collection that, if you have that burning desire to shoot it, you kind of misjudge things and blow it up, which is a very real possibility. I mean, if we're talking about, I mean, a lot of popular guns today that were not considered collectible even, you know, 30 or 40 years ago,
right.
Things like, you know, military surplus weapons, say, from World War One, guns that when I was a kid, you know, were, okay, they're 50 years old. Well, of course, now they're 100 years old.
Exactly.
And so you have to start looking at okay, what is the value of this? Is it the dollar value? You know, is it an ultra rare, irreplaceable kind of an example, or is it something that it just has a sentimental value to you? Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the issues where you, especially now that even guns that are considered to be of modern design are 100 years old. I mean, like a good example is the 1911 45 automatic. I mean, the gun is this year 100 years old. So there's examples of them that have been, you know, some of them have been sitting in a sock drawer for 100 years, but some of them have been in almost continuous use for 50 or 60 or 70 years. And although there, you can replace certain components to keep the thing running, you also have to think, okay, if this gun is a complete 100-year-old artifact, do I want to risk damaging it or breaking it or wearing it out, or do you want to preserve it as the artifact that it is? Plus 45 was a $500 gun for years and years and years. And I think the thing that really kind of kick-started the market for the 1911 in particular was the movie Saving Private Ryan. That, in conjunction with the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, turned the $500, you know, old Colt 45 pistol into a collectible. And now the same gun that 20 years ago was worth $500 is now worth $1,500 or $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I do have a Colt that was made in 1918. And, you know, I don't know if it went overseas with the Doughboys or if it sat in an armory in the United States for the whole time. But my dad bought it, shipped straight from a government arsenal in the early 60s when crazy stuff like that was possible. And, you know, he paid probably $18 for it or something. And I shot it I probably put 200 or 300 rounds through it over a period of years. But I haven't shot it now in about 10 years because I just thought, you know, I've got a new gun I could shoot instead. You know, why put the mileage on that gun? Why risk, if there's this part that was made in 1918, why risk breaking it and having to either try to find a replacement that came from some other gun? I mean, I have this sense that if the whole thing is an intact 1918 artifact, you don't want to wear parts out and replace them, you know. The reputation that the 1911 style pistol got as, oh, you know, you'll always hear about, oh, it shakes like a baby rattle and the parts are all loose. And those stories, I think, kind of arose out of people who were in the service in the 60s and 70s who were shooting guns that had been in military service for 20 or 30 or 40 years. And if you look at the pistols that were made early on, they're really, especially the very early ones that Colt was making before the U.S. got into World War I, they were essentially hand-built. Even though there were specifications, there were tolerances, the pistols were kind of finessed into shape. And before the war started, there really wasn't any urgency about making them. And then once production ramped up and it was going to be a matter of, you know, we've got to make thousands of these a month rather than thousands a year, and we have to get other manufacturers involved, now we've got to start being really serious about the idea of interchangeable parts. When Springfield Armory and Remington UMC started making, especially Remington UMC, after World War I had started, and they started to try to ramp up production of the pistols by finding commercial manufacturers to help with the production. Remington UMC looked at the sample pistols that Colt sent them and looked at the drawings and said, you know, these guns aren't up to spec. You know, we can't make the parts the way Colt makes them and have them up to spec because the pistols are essentially hand-fitted so that everything works rather than being built to a specific tolerance. Well, and then that problem became magnified in World War II when you not only had these old military pistols from World War I still in the system, but then you're bringing on more commercial manufacturers, Remington Rand and Union Switch and Signal and whatnot, trying to make pistols that had parts interchangeable with Colts and with the existing stocks of pistols. And so the tolerances were loosened somewhat on the M1911A1 pistols made in the 40s. To enhance this ability to be able to just take a slide that was made by Colt and put it on a frame that was made by Remington Rand. And then after 20 or 30 years of use, they did get pretty loose. But if you look at a Colt pistol made in between 1912 and even into 1918, I think Colt made more pistols in calendar year 1918 than they did the 6 years prior to that.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know,
yeah.
know that.
Yeah, and so you look at those early pistols, and they're very well put together. I mean, somebody commented somewhat facetiously that Colt can't make the pistols as well today as they did then without the pressure of war, you know, to urge them along. And it, to a certain extent, it's true that the early pistols that were made in the early years of World War One and prior to that really are pretty well put together. A friend of mine actually had a 1913 Colt.
Cool.
That had belonged to his dad, and it was one of the few that stamped on the slide model of 1911 U.S. Navy rather than model of 1911 U.S. Army.
Ah, okay.
And I got to shoot a few rounds through that, and that gun was built like literally like a Swiss watch. I mean, that was one of those guns from the early, you know, few thousand guns in terms of production volume, and it was a really well put together piece.
Would you shoot it?
No. Probably not. I mean, and one of the reasons is because the military was constantly refurbishing older weapons for reissue.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are relatively few World War One era weapons that are in their original World War One era condition in terms of finish and parts. They had been rebuilt prior to World War Two, maybe rebuilt during World War Two, after World War Two, and so you'll find a lot of these military pistols that are kind of a hodgepodge of older and newer parts from different eras. They've been refinished more than once. You'll often find, let's say, a World War One vintage gun that's had a World War Two or later barrel installed in it to keep it running while it's in U.S. military service. And those guns don't have much collector value just because of they're kind of a mutt. But this 1913 Colt that my friend had, after I took it apart and started looking at it, I could see that other than some very the 1911 pistol was not a static design. It had some features in 1911 that along in 1913, 1915 were being changed. And this pistol was in 1913 configuration. It had not been refurbished or updated. It at some point had been taken out of service either surreptitiously or officially. Probably before World War One, because it didn't have any of the updates or upgrades that were instituted, and if you believe the literature today, you know, were instituted across the board, not just on new guns, but were retrofitted to older ones.
Yeah.
So it's very rare to find a 1913-made pistol that hasn't had the kind of World War One era updates done to it. History student, I've got a history degree. Even as a kid, military history was my interest, and there are very few artifacts from, you know, long ago that you can kind of hold in your hand and get that connection to these events. And I've got an old Springfield Armory musket that was made in 1851.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother's great-grandfather, so my great-great-grandfather, was a Civil War veteran, and the musket came from his side of the family.
Really?
We don't know, you know, was it the actual musket he carried in battle in the war, or is it something he picked up at the flea market years later?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I keep it and preserve it and take care of it as if it was the very musket that he carried in combat.
That's neat.
Really, even if a gun is physically up to the task, I mean, if you've got a gun, a vintage gun, for which you can still get modern ammo that you can be fairly certain is going to go off, when you pull the trigger,
yeah.
You have to concern yourself with how current can you stay with a firearm that, as a collectible, you probably want to shoot fairly sparingly. And so I personally feel, you know, there was an old saying that owning a gun no more makes you armed than owning a piano makes you a musician.
Of course.
And so if you've got an old gun, like I was just thinking about this today, actually, in preparation for our conversation. My grandmother, who grew up in the Midwest in the early part of the 20th century, she was, she knew how to shoot. She was a farm girl. And later in life, she lived in an apartment in a big city by herself. And my dad gave her this old Webley revolver as her night table gun.
What kind of revolver?
A Webley break top British service revolver.
Okay.
And I've seen the thing, and you know, I just thought, boy, I suppose I would trust it to go off. It seems like it's in pretty good condition. But in my lifetime, the gun's never been fired. And so I'm thinking, you've got this gun on the nightstand. You've never fired it. You don't know if it's actually going to work, and you certainly don't go out and practice with it. It's probably not the best idea to have a gun like that for defense.
What's a really old 1911, maybe not one from 1918, defensive tool then?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think if it's a gun that's suitable, like for just as your example, a 45 1911, that's going to be a good weapon, piece of historical enjoyment, you know, any time. And in my case, I've got a newer 1911 pistol that I can put the mileage on. And so I'm going to, even if I wanted to occasionally put a few rounds through the older gun just to kind of, I guess, give it a little exercise now and then, I certainly wouldn't want to put a lot of rounds through it just to keep the mileage down on it. Because if it's something that you either cherish it because it's a sentimental issue or you've got a lot of money tied up in it, you don't want to risk breaking it. Wearing it out. I mean, you look at the value of firearms, and you can wear hundreds of dollars off the value just by shooting it a few times. Exactly. That's not far from it. I mean, if you look at the market for guns that are new in the box, unfired, versus guns that maybe are in 98% condition, even if they're fairly common firearms, you know, that can be $200, $300, $500 there just for shooting it. Really, it could be a few times.
Okay, good question. You said that you black powder guns.
I've got a few. I've not much shooting experience with them.
What do you have?
Well, I've got the old musket that belonged to my great-great-grandfather. I've got a matchlock musket that my dad picked up in Japan when he was there after the war. And I've been trying to find people that speak Japanese to kind of translate some of the markings on it, and I just kind of come up short. He thought it was 300 years old when he got it back in the 40s. And so that one, of course, I haven't shot that one, but it still, you know, kind of sits there in the safe.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a black powder Colt Frontier 6 shooter, which was in pretty ratty shape. I've got the original barrel that was on it. And
what cover is that?
It's 44-40 or 44 Winchester. And that's the salient feature of the Frontier 6 shooter is that all the Frontier 6 shooters were chambered in 44-40.
And so, can you find ammo for that, or do you load your own?
It's common ammo today because the cowboy action shooters have kind of caused a renaissance in some of these formerly obsolete calibers.
Okay.
I mean, it used to be that occasionally you could go into a gun store and find a box of Winchester or Remington factory ammo. The last time I saw a box of Winchester factory 44-40 ammo in the store, and this was pre-hoarding, this is where I'm talking like 8 or 10 years ago, 50 rounds was $40. And
ooh.
Yeah, it was a pretty rare and obscure cartridge, but the prevalence now of mostly the Italian-made knockoff pistols, there's, you know, a huge market for these cowboy caliber guns. And so the ammunition is actually more mainstream now than it has been in 100 years. You can go out and get factory-loaded 44 Colt ammo, which probably hasn't been factory available, you know, in 80 or 90 years. Even obscure calibers, even if they're fairly obscure and obsolete, there's something on the market that's close enough that you can modify a cartridge case and it will work, you know, maybe by shortening it or turning the rim down a little bit or something. So even fairly obscure guns, if you really want to shoot them, it's usually possible.
Yes.
The one that I'm using in the videos it's actually a commercial Colt that used to be called the M1991A1.
Okay.
And it was Colt's attempt. They were getting seriously undersold by the imports in the 90s, and so they dreamed up this idea of, instead of selling these kind of flossy polished versions of our pistols, let's do a kind of a military version that we can offer at a price that's competitive with the imports. And as kind of a little tie-in with their old military pistol, the M1911A1, they introduced the 1991A1 with a continuation of the military serial numbers.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and they made it for years, and it's still available now. Although they ditched the kind of matte military finish, but it was in the day it was kind of the starter entry-level Colt, and I bought one used and stripped it down and just kind of took made an assessment of the parts in it, whether I thought they were could be improved in terms of quality or configuration, and then kind of rebuilt it and had it refinished and whatnot. The pistol that we've just been discussing, it's chambered in 45 ACP. I shoot that in custom defensive pistol. Mm-hmm. And I have a Colt 38 Super that's set up in a, pretty much the same manner, similar features on it so that it's, you know, I can just switch back and forth without having to worry about, you know, the trigger pulls the same and whatnot. And so I shoot that in enhanced service pistol. And then I've also got a Smith & Wesson Model 22 revolver in 45 ACP that I shoot in enhanced service revolver. The gun that I carry the most frequently is a Daytonix Combat Master. It was the factory-made super compact 1911 variants, and they happen to just be made here in Seattle. So that was kind of another little reason it was interesting to me. 7 rounds, 3.5-inch barrel. And it just a lot of the stuff that you know was today was back in the 70s was kind of the area of custom pistol smithing, bowl barrels and extended guide rods, and a lot of that stuff that you know didn't work its way into the 1911 mainstream until the 80s and 90s was introduced in the Daytonix pistols in the 70s. Self talked about how my dad was able to buy this old GI 45 for something like $18 back in the early 60s. And, you know, and you look at old, I remember I've got some old American Rifleman magazines from the 50s and 60s, and you'll see
really?
That. Yeah. And they're kind of, it's fun to look through them because they've just got to, the prices of stuff especially is you know, kind of comical today. They're so cheap. But if you look at the buying power that people had back in the 50s and 60s, if you were paying $18 for something back then, you know, it's like paying $500 or more for something today. So what I did is I went back and got a bunch of old gun digests that showed, you know, the prices for new guns for a given year, and then just compared them to the consumer price index to get an idea of what did that gun actually cost back in the day compared to what somebody's earning power was. And then how does that compare with what it costs today?
Find out.
It's interesting. If you look at guns that are made by companies that take advantage of, you know, like modern manufacturing practices, like, say, Ruger has been making guns using mostly the investment casting process. And they moved from the kind of that the heartland of American gun making there on the East Coast. They've got their casting plant, I think, in Arizona. And so by using modern manufacturing techniques and trying to kind of save on their costs, they've done an extremely good job of keeping their guns at essentially the same price all through their production run. I mean, I did an analysis of what the Ruger Blackhawk revolver cost when it was introduced in the mid-50s and compared that to what it cost in the mid-90s. And in terms of the actual out-of-pocket cost is pretty much the same, and it has been, you know, for the entire production run.
What they paid for it back then to
the same. Exactly. And then you look at some other guns, for instance, like the Colt, the 1911 variants, Colt prices have gone up about 50% over the same period. And I think it's mostly because up until just very recently, Colt was still using, you know, the same kind of manufacturing techniques they were using 50 or 60 years ago. They were still forging their slides and their frames and doing multiple machining operations on everything. All the machines were operated by hand, you know, skilled labor, skilled union labor. You know, the Colt, you know, just was not changing their manufacturing processes to keep up either with more efficient, cheaper processes or with those more traditional processes being moved overseas.
Okay. Wow.
Well, the same is true of, you know, collectible guns. You know, I mean, like back in the 60s, in the 70s, there was a huge interest in collecting Lugers. And there used to actually be, I used to subscribe to Guns and Ammo magazine when I was, you know, 12 years old. And there was actually a monthly column on collecting Lugers in Guns and Ammo magazine. They'd be talking about, oh, you know, here we've identified this new model, and, you know, it's very rare, and you can get one for $5,000. And 20 years later, that same gun was worth $2,000. And even as the value of the dollar went down, just, you know, certain markets, you know, you can't necessarily predict the sustained collectability of something.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it varies. People's interests, their tastes vary, and something that's extremely rare or maybe is associated with a famous person, you know, you don't really know how the market's going to hold up on stuff like that. Well, and that's there's an old saying in collecting that they say, buy the gun, not the story. Story's unverifiable. What good is it? You know, and one of the things is that is kind of a positive byproduct of the increasing value of certain guns is it increases the interest level, and people then will take the time to do research and publish what they've found, and it actually it helps everybody. I mean, you look at same thing happened with collectible cars. You know, you had a car that 50 years ago was just an old car, and now you watch these auto auctions where a car that you could get for $5,000 30 years ago, they're $50,000 now, or $150,000.
I know. Yeah.
And the same thing happened in some segments of gun collecting. And I mean, I think the U.S. military weapons from World War II being an example of, you can now find one of my favorite guns of that era is the M1 carbine. And now you can find published lists of parts and what little manufacturer codes are supposed to be on each part. And if you have a gun that was made during this range of serial numbers, the trigger should be stamped with this mark, and the hammer should be stamped with that mark, and the stock should have this mark stamped here and there. And people take these books and use it like it's instructions, and will go out and buy an M1 carbine and strip all the parts off of it and shop around to find, you know, okay, here's a trigger with the little mark that I need, and here's the hammer, and here's the bolt, and assemble a gun from parts from the hinterland. And build it up and say, I've restored my carbine, you know, to the way it was back in the day. But, you know, in my mind, it's just a collection of parts because all those parts were originally on some other gun. Oh, yeah, yeah. And the value is it will kind of ebb and flow. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I'm a fan of watching the car auctions on the Speed Channel.
Yeah.
And they'll have a car that... you know, they'll actually say, you know, this car was at this auction last year, and last year it sold for $40,000, and this year it sold for $70,000, and sometimes it'll be the other way around, you know, because it, whatever the car is, it's not hot anymore. It's not, you know, for like last few auctions, the car that's been really hot is the Ford Mustang, and so if you've got a Shelby Mustang or a Boss 302 or one of these, you know, kind of iconic cars, the values are just going through the roof. I mean, a nicely restored Mustang is now selling for more than a similarly restored Corvette. You know, and then now I'm starting to see like the Mopar cars, the Hemi Cudas and that stuff. Now it's starting to pick up. And, you know, maybe in a few years, like you said, it's, you know, it'll be the LS6 Chevelles will be $150,000. Who knows? Yeah. And in the gun market, I think it's interesting in that it's something that even an expensive gun is not something that a typical person can't afford if they really want it. You know, like you look at a pristine, let's say back to the Colt 1911 or military issue 1911, a pristine gun from the World War II era can still be picked up for a couple thousand dollars, $2,000-$3,000.
Right.
You know, and that's something, if that's what you really want, you can still afford it, you know, and that's the kind of thing I think that it's, you know, kind of a common man collectible. It's something you don't have to be rich and famous to afford it. And so that's one of the things about gun collecting that I think is even really nice and really unusual examples of some guns are readily available to somebody who's willing to go out and look for it. And you can have a collection of a gun that's a type of gun that's fairly obscure and even in really nice shape. They're not really expensive just because they're kind of out of the collecting mainstream.
Nice.
And yeah, and so if I were in the market for any gun that wasn't brand new over the counter, that's probably where I'd start. And to, again, to avoid the cost of shipping. I mean, it's getting pretty prohibitive. One of the other things that started here recently in Washington State is now FFLs are not only required to do a background investigation and, of course, collect a transfer fee for transferring a firearm that's been, you know, sold across state lines, but now they're required to collect state sales tax.
Oh.
And so it used to be, as a Washington resident, if you could buy a gun off the internet, if it was a good value, even when you figured in the transfer fee and the shipping, you could still get a better deal than was likely to be found at a retail store in the Seattle area.
But applicable to Washington residents? Is this something that's changed in Washington?
The law has actually been in place in Washington for a number of years. It was just never very vigorously enforced. And so it is a Washington state law, and last transfer that I had done, it wasn't even a purchase that I'd made. It was our club puts on a big state championship match every year, and we give away a lot of guns as prizes, and so we had this big shipment of guns that would end up being given away as prizes in the match, and the FFL handles the transfer said, you owe, you know, like $200 in taxes on the $2,000 purchase.
Yeah.
And which makes us, you know, on the one hand, I'm just kind of like going, wow, I guess, you know, that's an increase in the cost of doing business. I mean, it's just,
yeah, no kidding.
You have to figure into it. But for the individual purchaser, I'm one of those people that kind of feels like if there's somebody trying to make a go of it as a gun retailer, especially in an urban area that's not especially friendly to guns, like Seattle sometimes is, I try to support my local retailer. But I remember the last time I think I bought a brand new gun, I called a local retailer and said, okay, I'd like to buy this gun from you, and here's the price I've been quoted from an online retailer. Can you match that price?
He said, that's
higher than the price I can get it for. So his wholesale purchase price was higher than the retail price that I was going to pay from another dealer. So I not only would have had to pay an extra like $50 for the gun, plus I'd have to pay another 10% in Washington State sales tax. So I probably, by buying the gun online, having it shipped to my FFL, paying the transfer fee, I might have saved $100. But that's not the case anymore, not to that extent, because now, of course, the FFL's got to collect the state sales tax, whether the state, you know, whether the sale is retail sale in state or it's just a gun that's being transferred. I think, all government agencies, government, you know, whether they're city, state, federal, they're all looking for ways to increase their revenues, and they found one here in Washington by, you know, putting the screws to the FFL holders to collect sales tax. And so, of course, the same is true of just about any investment you make now.
Right.
You know, it used to be the argument was, well, if you really want, you know, if you want to invest, get stocks and bonds, because at least you can count on a 10% annual increase. But even that's not the case anymore. But I would say, decide what it is you're trying to do. Is your interest in, is it money? Is it you want something that, so like some people, even though they're collectors, they're shooters as well. And so they'll collect not necessarily pristine examples of anything. They'll buy something that, you know, if they put a little extra wear on it, if it's already in 90% condition, they're not going to reduce the value very much if by shooting it they reduce the value to 88%. And so if you've got something, and especially if it's a gun that isn't really expensive, but there are a number of variations, that's one of the things you'll find. You know, certain guns, let's say, especially if it's a military surplus weapon that was made in Warsaw Pact countries, you'll find a similar gun that was manufactured in Poland and in East Germany and in Russia and in Hungary. And none of them cost even $500. So you could have a collection of one from each country and only have a couple of grand invested. Better have one of each. And stuff like that. You know, it's just you start, the more you know, the more you probably want to collect.
Right.
Yeah, and I've found out a lot. I mean, a lot of what I know about the older vintage guns that I have, I discovered in researching whether or not it's a gun I should be shooting or not, either because You know, is it too valuable to shoot, or is it safe to shoot? And you know, especially when you're looking at guns that were produced in the kind of the transition period from black powder to smokeless powder, from like the 1890s to say 1910 or prior to World War One, there was a period there where you had guns that were designed and put into production during the black powder era, but their production ran into the smokeless powder era. But you don't necessarily know that the gun, the metallurgy, the heat treatment, and whatnot is up to snuff 120 years later to be firing it with modern smokeless powder. And the thing that really got me into it is this Colt six shooter that I have that was made in 1897. And it's popularly older Colts like that are often described as either having a black powder frame or a smokeless powder frame. And the feature that distinguishes the two is either a screw or a spring-loaded catch that retains the cylinder base pin. And so the older Colts that were made from the 1870s up until the early to mid-1890s had a single screw that screwed in through the front of the frame. And then because that feature was changed at about the same time that smokeless powder was introduced, the guns that have the later cylinder pin retention are referred to as smokeless powder. Well, I determined that from doing research over the years that this so-called smokeless powder frame was introduced about 1895, and Colt didn't warrant their pistols against smokeless powder until 1903. So you had this period of about 8 years where the guns were still being made for smokeless powder. And then finally, after the turn of the century, Colt, you know, they either improved their materials or had gotten up to speed on, you know, heat treatment and whatnot to withstand the pressures and the pressure curves of smokeless powder, which were very different from black powder. But you just wonder if I had a peacemaker that was made in 1905, I don't know that I would think, oh, okay, it's safe to shoot smokeless powder in it, just because it might have been in 1905. I don't know that I would necessarily assume that it is today.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an insatiable reader, and it used to be, you know, I mean, pre-internet, you had to either go to the library or buy books, and, you know, I used to try to find all the information I could on the topics that were interesting me. And, you know, like I said earlier, I think I'll focus in on something, like trying to determine. I had this old Colt peacemaker. Am I going, okay, can I just go down to the store and buy ammo and shoot it? Or do I need to load black powder for it, you know? And so it took me a number of years of research before I felt comfortable and just said, you know, I don't want to, even if I could shoot smokeless powder in it, what if I did and I blew it up, you know? Then there's one less Colt, you know, peacemaker, and I've lost something that not only has monetary value, but it's, you know, kind of a family heirloom kind of a thing too.
Yeah, cool.
Power Factor Show. The Power Factor Show is it's a video podcast, and we're now affiliated with the Gun Rights Radio Network. And the idea behind the show was actually Steve and I are the faces of the show, but all the work is actually being done by the show's producer. And what we wanted to do is a show that would introduce people to practical pistol competition, meaning either USPSA, IPSC, or IDPA. Steve is especially, I met Steve through USPSA competition. That's how we know each other. And we, in our area, in the Seattle area, we conduct an intro to IPSC class. Three times a year, we try to get 10 students to come to the range and run them through a day of classroom instruction, and then we'll coach them through their first match to get them up to speed on the competition. And so we thought that would kind of serve as a basis for the show. And we started out, each episode touches on an aspect of kind of getting a person up to speed who's interested in the practical shooting sports, but they don't really know how to get started. And so we've talked about equipment. We've talked about how to find a local club, what you need to know, rules, et cetera. And the more episodes we make, the more specific we're going to get on various topics. Right now it's all overview, you know, how to get started in things.
Yeah, and I like that.
Yeah, and we'll have – probably a dozen episodes that lead up to the Your First Match episode. And then from then on, we'll start getting into more details about techniques and whatnot. Right now, it's mostly equipment and very basics. You know, here's how to hold the gun kind of stuff. But we're going to get into calculating hit factors and how to break down a stage to shoot it the most efficiently and, scoring targets. And it's just going to hopefully we'll get feedback. And that will, direct us to about topics for future episodes. Gun Rights Radio Network, other podcasts and stuff. So I've found some information, source for information that I was.
All right. Rick, thanks for that terrific education on collectible firearms. Hope you guys enjoyed that. As I mentioned, he seems like he's a wealth of knowledge on that subject. So we also discussed, you couldn't hear it because I had to cut part of it out because of the rotten echoes. We discussed him coming back on for a part two, so I promise if he comes back on for a part two, I'll get my recording software right. I'll figure this stuff out once and for all and figure out what's causing the problems. And I would appreciate some questions from some of you, and I think Rick would too. So I'll start a thread on this show on the GRRN forums, and if you have some questions about collectible firearms for Rick, then I think he'd be very happy to answer them. Okay. As I close out the show, I want to mention that I'm going to do something pretty special here to help preserve our gun rights. So I'm going to go ahead and use this show as an official announcement. I'm worried, folks. I don't know about you. I don't know if you share the same worry I do. I still think we have a long way to go to preserve our Second Amendment rights and to get them back to where they should be. I mean, all this nonsense that we still have to go through, all this nonsense with some states being a shall issue state, some states being a may issue state, and there's so many restrictions on where you can carry and so many restrictions on open carry in a lot of places and so on and so forth. And now you got pinheads in Washington that are trying to bring back gun control legislation because of the Tucson shooting, because they don't understand what happened. It's crazy. It's craziness. And I think that we need to continue to support organizations that are fighting for our cause. And if you recall, when I did the Freedom Raffle several months ago, the Second Amendment Foundation was one of the beneficiaries of the money that I raised. They got a third of the money. Thanks to you. You guys were great. You guys were very, very supportive. I like the Second Amendment Foundation. I'm going to personally endorse the Second Amendment Foundation. I'm going to recommend that you help the Second Amendment Foundation out. Why? Well, they were extremely influential, if not the driving force, in the Heller versus Chicago decision. McDonald versus Chicago. The Heller case was in D.C. They're just very aggressive. They've got tons of lawsuits. I think they've got 10 or 12 lawsuits that are already either planned or have been filed and are in progress. And these guys are actually advancing the Second Amendment rights out there. I have nothing against the NRA. I just renewed my NRA membership recently. So I'm a firm believer in both organizations. But I'm going to make the beneficiary of this next fundraising event, the Second Amendment Foundation, once again. So here's the way it's going to work. I still got my CD and my digital download available, and I'm going to keep it available until the 15th of February. On the 15th of February, I'm going to release part number two. And a lot of folks have already been sending me some good feedback on part number one, a couple of hours worth of shooting skills and gun stuff that I've never covered before. This is exclusive information, folks. This is not a repeat of stuff that I've covered in the previous 105 episodes. That's been going very well. From now until the 15th of March, I'm going to donate a half of the proceeds, 50% of all the proceeds from the sales of my CD and digital download to the Second Amendment Foundation. So all you have to do is invest $15. You'll get some good information from me and Steve Zofi and a few other people that are on the digital download. $15, half of it will support my show. Half of it is going to go to the Second Amendment Foundation. About the middle of March, right around the 15th of March or so, is how long I'm going to run this effort. So let's help them out, folks. You're going to get a benefit from this. You're going to get some excellent information, and you're going to be helping out a good cause, which is the Second Amendment Foundation. Let's see if we can get them some good support. Folks, money talks. That's just the way it is. That's the way it is in politics. That's the way it is in lobbying. That's the way it is in litigation and so forth. Money talks. So let's put our money where our mouths are. We like to preserve our rights. We like to make sure that they're not taken away from us. Let's support the organizations that help us do that, okay? So all you have to do is go to handgunworld.com, click the Buy Now button, and 99% of you have asked for a digital download. It's really simple. I send you an email with instructions on a different website to go to and download the whole thing as an MP3 file. And then you could do whatever you want after that. You can burn it to a CD, put it on your iPod, MP3 player, what have you. If you have any questions about that, just go to handgunworld.com and just click the CD digital download link. All right, so that wraps it up, folks. Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Handgun World Show. My name is Bob Main. I'm your host, and the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Hope you had a great time with this interview, and I'll catch you next time. Goodbye.